Welcome to Grumpy Strategists, episode 53. I'm your host, SAA's Michael Shoebridge, and I'm joined in the bunker by Dr. Marcus Hellyer, the eminent head of research here at SAA. Marcus, good
afternoon. Michael, how are you? Yes, back in the bunker. We did manage to get the kayak out of the bunker. Unfortunately, we had to cut it into four segments, but that did allow you to drop in a plug. Much like, you know, Virginia-class submarine Block 4, you've dropped in a plug, four vertical launch cells. They look beautiful. It's going to be great.
It's the KPM. It's the kayak payload module.
Okay. It's going to be great.
And it's very good for littoral operations.
Well, I think it is going to be the apex predator of Lake Burley Griffin.
It will be. The littoral of Lake Burley Griffin, anyway. So, look, so much has been happening, not just kayaks and bunker work. We've got some fantastic news for Australian industry out of the Australian Department of Finance.
Fantastic in air quotes, yes.
Yeah. Well, there's a level of good news that's then undermined by what it actually means, which is the way of a lot of government announcements. Mm-hmm. We've also got fast-moving industrial shenanigans around Aussie shipbuilders, mm-hmm. the Koreans and the Japanese. Mm-hmm. So it'd be good to talk about that. And a little bit of exciting international agreement making.
Mm-hmm. Very good.
And then a bit about how it's going to be really easy to crew up the Australian Army's Apache helicopters.
Well, we're going to have so many of them. They're going to be going cheap.
Yeah, that Five Eyes recruitment pipeline is going to open up in a big way. So we'll talk about that. But let's get into this new definition of Australian industry out of the Department of Finance. Because one of the real low points under the current government is the Defence Department convinced ministers to put out that definition of sovereign Australian industry that dictates how defence directs a lot of its money, that was about having an Australian business number so that Huawei, Hikvision or Lockheed Martin were all Aussie, as Aussie as can be.
I think if we can sum up the problems with the current defence definition of sovereign Australian defence industry, it is anybody in the world can be sovereign Australian defence industry.
If you want to contract with them as a defence official, they are sovereign. You can make that happen. But the Department of Finance has put a stop to that with its new definition, Marcus.
Well, sort of. Well, let's read the new definition. And I think we both like this new definition. It says, an Australian business is a business, including any parent business, that has 50% or more Australian ownership. So at least half-owned Australian. Or is principally traded on an Australian equities market and is an Australian resident for tax purposes. So you can't be one of those shonky multinationals that's based in Ireland or the Virgin Islands or somewhere like that. Yeah. And is a business that has its principal place of business in Australia. So I think we think that sounds pretty good. That sounds pretty good. Aussie. There is just one wrinkle.
And what's that?
The wrinkle is it doesn't really matter that much for defence purposes because by my reading of the Commonwealth procurement rules, a government entity only has to go to an Australian company under this new definition, for contracts which are valued below $125,000, which in the defence space doesn't really buy you very much.
No, I mean, that would be meaningful for SAA.
I dream of $125,000 out.
but
you're all right, my Christmases at once.
That is not going to change the direction of the investment program in any way.
No.
There's another wrinkle as well. Right at the front of the Commonwealth procurement rules, I think it's paragraph 2.6, there's something that says the accountable authority can decide not to use these rules if they want to do so for security or other considerations. So
even if it was less than $125,000, if a defence official's gammy leg is telling them that it's important to go overseas, they can still go overseas.
For security reasons. So the Defence Department doesn't have to adopt this new definition, and I suspect they won't, even for procurements less than $125,000.
And the CPRs are very explicit in the FAQs, the frequently asked questions. The question is, can procuring entities use the Australian business definition to preference Australian businesses for procurement valued above the procurement thresholds? And the very clear answer is no.
Okay. So you can't run a defence procurement that says I must procure this from Australian businesses using the new finance definition. Yeah.
So unfortunately, even though it's a much better definition in our view, it's kind of irrelevant.
Yeah. Well, of course, it is in the accountable authority's hands, the Secretary of the Department of Defence's hands, to direct procurement towards Australian businesses for supply chain or security considerations. In fact, they've got the power in the procurement rules themselves.
Yes, I mean, if you look at the Department of Finance's, they have some guidance there on what constitutes value for money. It's very clear in there that, you know, lowest cost is not the primary driver. There are a number of factors that decision makers can take into account in determining value for money, and Australian industry impact is one of them.
Yep.
So it actually is, despite our sort of cynicism here, it is possible for decision makers in defence to go, this is a really important capability for Australia to produce here. Ooh, we need the industrial base to do it.
Yep.
You know, so we are going to go to Australian companies. They have that ability already.
Yeah, yeah. So look, if I'm going to be hopeful about this, I'm hopeful that the Australian officials that are going to revise the industry policy are going to lift that finance department definition and adopt it for their own defence industry policy instead of that absurd definition that they currently have of sovereign is everyone.
Well, interestingly, when I've looked at some defence approaches to market for various things, at that sort of individual approach to market level, they do describe sort of what we would regard as sovereign defence capability along in terms such as we need to ensure supply in times of crisis and conflict.
Yeah.
So at the working level, people seem to get it.
Yeah.
So I'm not completely pessimistic. But
no. I think the main problem is very senior officials and ministers don't want to have a stick that's going to be used to beat them by showing that so much of their money is just going to foreign businesses. That is the problem. Anyway, moving on. So speaking of foreign businesses, the Henderson precinct, before the bulldozers even move in, because the bulldozers don't know where to go because the boundaries of the precinct and the land ownership issues haven't been sorted, there's commercial knife fights underway around Austal and Hanwha Roshan and a very quiet, but I'd say highly motivated, Mitsubishi Heavy Industries.
Well, if we sort of go back a year or so, our listeners might recall that Hanwha wanted to buy a chunk of Austal, the Aussie shipbuilder based in Henderson in Western Australia, which
mind you, that was back when the South Koreans were still in the general purpose frigate competition.
It was still an open competition. Yeah. So back then, Hanwha wanted to buy a chunk of Austal. At the time, a number of observers, including ourselves, said, gosh, if the South Koreans are one of the owners of Austal, that may raise problems with the Japanese wanting to build their ship there. Yep. I mean, are they going to want to build their ship at a shipyard owned by the South Koreans? Now, I don't have a problem with either of the South Koreans or the Japanese, but we all know they have a very difficult relationship, particularly in the defence space.
Well, they're also really hard-nosed industrial competitors, the Japanese shipbuilders and South Korean shipbuilders. So there's an industrial competition aspect to this beyond the political issues.
And a year on, well, and at the time, in response to the naysayers such as ourselves, Defence Minister / Deputy Prime Minister...
No, you've got that round the wrong way.
Sorry, Deputy Prime Minister...
Who is also...
/ Defence Minister, yeah. Richard Miles, said, it's not a problem. We don't have any concerns about this. His exact words were... Ultimately, this is a matter for Austal. They are a private company. From the government's perspective, we don't have any concern about Hanwha moving in this direction. Well, a year down the track, Hanwha actually want to buy even more of Austal.
Right.
And not surprisingly, the Japanese are a bit, we're not too sure about this. So now the Japanese have won the C-3000 general purpose frigate competition, but they're being faced with the conundrum of having to build it at a shipyard owned by a South Korean company.
But this will, that the Hanwha Ocean bid to increase its investment will go to the Foreign Investment Review Board, presumably, and the Treasurer will have to make a decision. So Richard Marles, sitting over in Defence or in the Acting Prime Minister's office with a big hat, may have no concerns about it, but unfortunately the decision-maker here is going to be the Treasurer.
But presumably the Treasurer is going, oh, this is a defence issue, national security issue. I should turn to my colleague who is responsible for providing me advice on this, which would be, oh, the Minister for Defence / Deputy Prime Minister. And Richard doesn't seem to have an issue with that.
Well, I think Richard may have some new information now, which is a highly motivated Japanese government and Mitsubishi Heavy Industries saying, we are not on your Nelly handing over incredibly valuable intellectual property to our arch competitor. So this is just not something we're going to do, Minister. So I think Mr. Miles may now have some information he might need to provide the Treasurer.
But to me, this is yet another example of the government sort of weird swinging between, well, it's a commercial matter, we'll let industry decide on the one hand, and then at the other end of this sort of intervention into the market.
There's only one way.
Yeah. And these captain's picks.
Yeah.
And unfortunately, when they will let the market decide and then they'll go, wrong answer.
Yeah.
So we saw that with the Landing Craft Medium, where a consortium made up of Burden, an Australian company, did the design, and they were going to work with, I forget who it was, but not Austal.
Yeah.
And the government came along and said, no, that's the wrong answer. We want Austal to build it. So they had this forced marriage between.
I like the Burden design, but I want Austal to build it. So how about, even though you companies didn't partner, you're now happy new partners.
Yeah, so they went from, well, we'll just leave it up to the market to go, wrong answer, we're going to inject ourselves into the market, do this forced marriage. Well, similarly, and by the way, that forced marriage doesn't seem to have worked out because we, a couple of weeks ago, saw a media release from Austal saying, no, we're going to take over the design.
Yeah, yeah, by Burden, you're out of the picture and now it's all me.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
Similarly, in the frigate space, the government basically told everybody, you have to work with Austal. But who owns Austal? We'll leave that up to the market.
Yeah. It's back to that, my favourite Joe Bjelke-Petersen quote, you can't sit on the fence and keep your ear to the ground without terrible things happening. It's that same problem. So I just think this is yet another unfolding debacle around Henderson and Australian shipbuilding. Because to me, the government has created this mess for itself. When Hanwha first put in its bid, the direction from the government, our government, should have been, if you win the general purpose frigate, let's talk. But otherwise, it's not happening. Because this just is not feasible politically or industrially for the Japanese, have won the competition.
I have to say, the vibe out there is not good about Henderson in general and the general purpose frigate program. So a journo friend of mine who was at Indo-Pacific a couple of weeks ago, as was I, said they were on the floor taking the temperature, and they said that not a single person they spoke to thought that a single Mogami frigate would ever be built in Henderson. Now, I'm not quite that pessimistic, but the vibe is not one, you know, brimming with confidence.
Well, and the timeline for having the first Australian build of the Mogami is really short. So if they're going to start delivering them from the Japanese shipyards from 2029, then the build transfer has to start in the very early 2030s, because otherwise the Japanese build ones have popped out. And there's a big gap.
Well, okay, so let's review the numbers. First Japanese-built one is meant to arrive in 2029. The government seems to be talking about a sort of a annual one-year drumbeat, maybe 1.5-year drumbeat. So second one maybe 2030, 31-ish. Third one 2032 maybe.
And then it's meant to be Aussie 2033.
First Aussie one, you're going 2033 maybe.
And you can't say, hey, Henderson, your time starts now. You've got 12 months to build a ship.
Yeah.
So there's a lead time.
You count back from 2033. If we think 2033 is when the first Aussie-built one is meant to be delivered, you go, well, five-year build, best case. I mean, when have we ever built a proper big, complex, major surface combatant in less time than that? So you're going 5-6 years, so that gets you back to 27-28. We haven't even started work on a shipyard. We haven't got a design for a shipyard. That's only 2 years away.
Mm-hmm. And we're at the end of 2025 as we speak.
So
I know the government's $12 billion announcement about Henderson was meant to give everyone confidence and certainty.
Yeah, except.
But unfortunately, there simply are not enough facts and a timeline that shows what's possible.
Well, the problem with that $12 billion figure is, from Senate estimates, defence officials were asked, so how do you know it's $12 billion? Noting that that's only the first chunk, the total is $25 billion. How do you know it's $12 billion? Oh, we've done a lot of work. We kind of understand what has to be done. Okay, if you understand what has to be done, why haven't you told stakeholders like the government, like industry, like the other users of the Henderson precinct, what is actually going to happen? Well, we haven't gotten that far yet. We haven't done enough work. So you've done enough work or you haven't done enough work?
On the one hand, you've done all this work that lets you have absolute confidence in the numbers, but then you haven't done any work that lets you give anyone any detail about what's to be done.
Yeah.
And I think it's that second bit that is the most important.
Meanwhile, poor old Mitsubishi Heavy Industries are looking at this schmozzle going, okay, it's a bit of a schmozzle. We don't know exactly how we're going to work with Austal. And meanwhile, you're saying our Korean rivals are going to buy a big chunk of Austal. So again, I think people who don't have warm and fuzzy feelings about this are probably, there's something to it.
Yeah. But was there some good news about the Hunter program? I think the Admiral who's responsible for it has come out strong. Commodore.
Not everybody is an Admiral yet in the Navy.
Well, look, if it's going to be done seriously, they've got to promote this guy.
So BAE's put out, I guess, a lot of criticism of the Hunter program, including perhaps by you yourself, Michael.
I think it's scandalous. It should be cancelled. The cost of these warships, $9 billion each, and that's not counting the cost of the shipyard. It is scandalous.
Yes. Well, so BAE's, if they're pushing back, they're entitled to push back a bit. So they've put out some good news stuff. They've put out a video saying everything's going well. But
this reminds me of how they won it. They had this very big multimedia push because they said it's all digital, this thing. You know, you can pretty much live in the ship now. It's live as a digital thing. Mm-hmm. They spent a huge amount of money with sort of digital presentations about it.
If World War III is fought in the holodeck, we're good.
Yeah.
Because it's there already.
BAE had the biggest audio-visual displays up at Indopac. So now they put out a video telling us the Hunter program's good. The only problem is, BAE are not Walt Disney. They're meant to be building a ship, not producing audiovisual material.
Well, there's a couple of things in this video that, okay, they're cutting steel. Fine, right? I've heard from other people that the design isn't actually complete, so what actually goes into the steel is not ready to go. That may or may not be true. I can't stand by that. But what really gets my goat is in this video, The claim is made that the criticism of the program is undermining morale in the shipyard.
Oh, that's tragic.
And it's like, oh, so you critics, shut the F up because you're making everybody sad. And to me, that's like all of the AUKUS boosters and defenders who go, well, the reason AUKUS could fail, it's because of all you critics. All you critics undermining us. So shut the F up and stop criticizing and get on board. Just get on board.
It's not because it's not a good idea and it's not being done well. That's not the problem. The problem is there are critics. And that is such a glass-jawed, empty gesture to me.
Shut the F up because you're making the welders sad.
Oh, dear.
Okay. And then the other thing I find very objectionable, and I find is the last refuge of the scoundrel, is this response that, well, yeah, of course it costs a lot of money, but that's not because it's an expensive ship. It's because it's a nation-building enterprise.
Oh, no.
The Hunter class is as much a nation-building enterprise as it is a warship acquisition. And my view is, I don't give a flying F about whether defence is doing nation building. Your job is to defend me, and I want you to buy capability, and I want you to do it cost effectively and on time. I do not care about what nations you may or may not be building.
I agree. I think that's almost an admission of failure from a defence program official to have to clutch it. But this isn't really just about the warship. I'm building the nation. No, your day job, buddy boy, is to give the Navy the capability it needs to defend our country in a very nasty strategic environment. So focus on your job and stop whinging.
Yes, and I say that as a full-throated, wholehearted supporter of Australian defence industry. But don't give me this flim-flammery about nation building. No, again, it echoes of the hollow boosterism around AUKUS, that AUKUS, it's the biggest industrial exercise this country has ever done, and it's about nation building.
It isn't. It's about slowly assembling 8 largely foreign objects and putting them to work as part of a combined US-Australian fleet.
And meanwhile, to do that, you've sucked 20,000 smart, talented, capable Australians out of productive sectors of the Australian economy where they could be generating wealth and IP for the country.
But look, I want to see... I've seen the pictures of the Hunter frigate. I'm now really keen to see the movie. And hopefully, I can get the shirt. Who knows, at some point, there might be a warship.
Well, sorry, and just incidentally, another claim made in this video as well is the Norwegians have also picked the Type 26, so it must be a good thing. And it's like, well, first of all, they're fighting a different adversary in a different part of the world, probably with different operating concepts. Ooh. So just because they're doing it, doesn't mean it's a good thing.
Well, also,
doesn't validate our decision.
I think they've made a bad decision, that the cost of this, the opportunity cost for everything else in your military, it's like the AUKUS debate. It is just very bad value for money. And luckily for the Norwegians, they're part of a bigger construct called NATO. But the idea that, well, because someone else has bought it, it must be a good thing, that just is more silliness to my mind.
Well, plus, the other thing is people in the UK are going, hang on, we're running out of frigates. We're running out of destroyers and frigates. You know, no secret there. But the Type 26 is meant to be coming. We can sort of see the first one on the horizon, and there's a couple more just behind it coming down the track. They're all now going, hang on, the Norwegians aren't building their own Type 26s. They're going to buy them off our production yard, off our production line. Oh, holy crap, we could lose the ships we thought were coming into the Royal Navy. Some of them are going to be diverted to the Norwegian Navy. So it's kind of a zero-sum game for NATO.
Well, yeah, and that's, you know, we've talked about this before, that the build timeline for these vessels, whether it's the Royal Navy or the even slower Royal Australian Navy, is so absurdly slow, particularly given we're meant to have built this wonderful digital shipyard, more of the digital age sort of stuff that is so fantastic, but it's not letting us build them any faster or cheaper.
No, that was the big selling point of the new shipyard, which in my understanding is not part of the $27 billion. That's an additional pot of money. It was sold as it was going to do things faster, it was going to do things cheaper, and it was going to do things with less people.
Yeah.
Instead, it's slower. It costs a lot more money, and there's still an awful lot of people involved, and it still seems to be a job creation scheme for South Australia.
Yeah. Well, look, let's move on to other news. We've had the Australian...
Sorry, my apologies to any welders in South Australia who I've made
affected
sad.
Their morale.
I'm sorry. Yeah.
Look, the welds are going to be great on those others, at least the Aussie welds. Now, other big news, the Australian government and the Indonesian government have signed up a big new defence treaty. It's got a parallel with Paul Keating signing up a deal with then authoritarian Indonesian strongman Suharto just before he fell from power because the people couldn't put up with him any longer. So
and that treaty then fell over.
That treaty then fell over. It was all done in secret, that treaty too, and celebrated.
Like this one.
This one has been done in secret and celebrated. In fact, Prime Minister Albanese has a vote, the Keating era treaty, as a good thing, just gliding over that problem of signing it up with an authoritarian strongman at the end of his reign and the whole thing turned to poo. This one, it has apparently a clause in it, we don't know too much because it's all very secret, about consulting if there's a danger to one. So very like the ANZUS Treaty, I think, Mike.
I do have to say I was struck by the similarities in language between this treaty, the Australia-Indonesia Treaty on Common Security, and the good old ANZUS Alliance. But I do, when I look at the two, even though there's similar language, I'm not really getting a similar sense that there is the same weightiness to them. Noting, as we have over the past year, that we have some concerns about ANZUS, but even the current state of ANZUS, I think you do have to say is a little weightier than this new treaty with Indonesia.
Yeah, well, I did find it a bit of comedic theatre to have the agreement signed on the deck of HMAS Canberra, or announced on the deck of HMAS Canberra, one of the big landing helicopter dock amphibious ships that was subject to that scathing audit report saying they're very badly maintained, that they're unreliable, they've failed on formal missions. So I did think there was a bit of a all hat, no ranch element to the Australian government signing this with Indonesia. And we seem to be entering partnerships with everybody. You know, we're negotiating one with the EU. We've just signed the Puk Puk one with PNG, now with Indonesia. Who's next that we're going to say, hey, you know, in times of common danger, we'll be right there with you. Meanwhile, our defence force is disappearing up its own fundament because of the budget crisis that it's in.
Well, look, I'll try to be Mr. Positive here.
Well, I thought that was reasonably positive. Yeah. Well, I'm positive it's no good.
Look, the more optimistic interpretation is yes, there are concerns about the shifting great power balance, concerns about the US's ability to ensure peace in the Western Pacific, concerns about the rise of Chinese power and what does a Western Pacific under Chinese hegemony look like, or hegemony, depending on your pronunciation.
Or jackboot.
You'll be in trouble. Chinese ambassador's going to be on the line. So, you know, in times such as these, we see hedging. Everybody else starts going, all right, I can't put all my eggs in the US basket. We need to hedge. Now, Indonesia had never put any of its eggs in the US basket or the Chinese basket. And it had this resolutely independent, self-reliant foreign policy.
Enemies to no one, friends to all.
And we're sort of seeing a few little changes there. And, you know, so they're looking around going, well, maybe we do need to deepen our relationships with other partners. And you could go, well, Australia's doing a similar thing along the lines of the...
Let me just finish. You know,
so we've been developing our relationship with Japan over several decades now. And a number of commentators say, well, our relationship with Japan now is as close as you can kind of have to a country without it being a sort of formal military reliance. I can see the positives here. You are a lot more skeptical, cynical.
Well, yes, partly because I think evoking the Suharto era, particularly given the election of President Prabowo, who actually does have a lot of strongman tendencies in his past and even in his behaviour now.
You're going to get a call from the Indonesian ambassador as well.
Well, I'm just looking. Before he was sworn in as Indonesian president, as president-elect, he went off to Moscow and announced that he wanted to deepen security and economic relations with Russia, right in the middle of the Ukraine war. There's the Russian spaceport being developed in Indonesia, I think, with a bunch of Russian security, intelligence and military people pootling around there.
He did go to the 50th anniversary of China's victory in the Pacific.
Yeah, and
hung out with Xi Jinping, Putin and Kim Jong-un. So, yes, we are not particularly his special friend.
He may be signing Indonesia up to buy Chinese fighter aircraft, the J-10. I just think that Indonesia under Prabowo is going in a direction that is actually aligning itself more with countries like Russia and China, and he's not going to put a whole lot of ballast into the security relationship with Australia. And what common danger are we going to join together to meet? I just think this is... It's definitely a paper agreement without much underneath.
Well, there is that kind of awkward situation that we now have a security treaty with Indonesia and with PNG. Papua New Guinea. And sort of the big tension between those two countries is the Irian Jaya separatists, freedom fighters, independence fighter, whatever you want to call them, who sometimes cross the border to escape Indonesia into PNG, and that is a source of tension. So, of course, the big question arises, whose side are we on there?
We've just signed a similar arrangement where PNG will consult with us saying, hey, those Indonesians are causing me great trouble on the border. And we'll get a call from Jakarta saying those Papua New Guineans are causing me great trouble on the border. We're going to help them both.
Mm.
So that's really terrific. I even see it in the commercial reporting now. All these partnerships and strategic arrangements and understandings and MOUs, they're all a substitute for outcomes in the real world. We seem to think paperwork and documents are outcomes, and they're not.
No, look, you know, we've talked for the last couple of years a lot about alliances and, you know, are alliances based on interests or are they based on values? Bottom line is not all alliances are equal, and indeed some things that are described as alliances aren't actually alliances at all, and some relationships that have no kind of formal alliance structure around them are actually very robust in other ways. So in the last few months, technically we've gone from having two formal treaty allies, the US and New Zealand, and now we can add to them PNG and Indonesia. But I don't think anybody seriously thinks that these treaty arrangements with PNG and certainly Indonesia are equal in terms of gravitas to our relationship with the US and New Zealand.
I just think we're writing checks we can't cash. That's my problem. Now, just to finish up with a couple of bits of US news, I know you had...
Sorry, are you talking about emails that may or may not have been released recently, or it's something else?
No, it's something else. It's not former princes, not emails, not photos.
Yeah.
It's Golden Dome, I think.
Yes.
There was something you wanted to say. First, the guy that did the study wasn't with Heritage Foundation. Well, it was with another prominent American.
Yes. All right. So last time we talked about Golden Dome and we referred to a report by Todd Harrison, I think I might have said he worked for Heritage Foundation, which has been in the news for all the wrong reasons recently.
Mega trouble at Heritage.
Trouble for Heritage about its stance on MAGA.
Yeah.
No, Mr. Harrison is at the American Enterprise Institute, which is another fairly conservative American think tank. But what I wanted to do is just sort of come back and sort of close the loop on what Mr. Harrison was saying that is of relevance to us. So Mr. Harrison said, you know, the President Trump's concept of Golden Dome would cost, I think we said it was 2.5 Musks.
Yes.
Or $2.4 trillion.
$2 trillion, yep.
And would take a very, very long time. But he said there are a whole bunch of other options that are deliverable for a lot less money right now using existing capabilities. And that circles back to where Australia is at with its integrated air and missile defense conundrum.
Yeah.
Because we will recall the Defense Strategic Review said, do something quick. You know, don't reinvent the wheel.
Yep. You know, get practical. Don't spend billions of dollars on an elegant electronic system for orchestrating things that you don't have.
Yeah. Meanwhile, defense's response to, well, why in the light of this advice did you actually take integrated air and missile defense out of the integrated investment program completely? Defense keeps saying, well, there's no solution out there yet. If there was one, we'd get it, but we just have to wait until there is a solution. Well, there are solutions. Yeah. It may not solve every single conceivable threat that's out there against every conceivable asset you would want to defend, but there are solutions out there right now,
well,
if you wanted to pursue them.
Of course there are, and we've seen the Israelis and the Ukrainians employ those solutions. So we know there are missile and counter-drone defense systems that are quite effective and procurable.
But if you want to wait for perfection, it's probably going to take decades, and it's going to end up costing 2.5 Musks.
Yes, yes. Well, look, I've got some good news
for
the Australian Defense Department. We've had a lot of trouble recruiting people and retaining skilled people.
Really? This is news to me.
No, that's not the good news. That's the bad news.
Yeah.
But the good news is that Five Eyes recruitment pipeline is going to open up in a really big way for rotary wing, air crew and maintainers.
Why is that?
Well, because the US Army has already announced it's going to downsize the number of rotary wing aviators from about 30,000 by 6,500. They're cutting, that's over 20% of their air crew.
Well, that's great. We can recruit them.
They'll be available for us. And that's,
so, but why are they getting rid of them?
Oh, well, this is a bit awkward. It's because they're recognising that aviators used to be the way to get awareness to the soldiers, but now
needed people to fly the things up in the sky.
Yeah, but okay. Now soldiers can get that awareness about what's happening in the airspace by using systems they control themselves, like drones.
And well, this isn't one of those lessons you don't want to learn from Ukraine, is it?
No, it's the lesson that the US Army is learning from Ukraine. Okay. So the US Army is also considering cancelling future acquisition of crewed rotary wing, i.e. helicopter aircraft.
Crewed, C-R-U-D-E?
No, ones with people in them. And that's why they're downsizing the number of aviators. So, but fortunately, Australia is in the middle of buying crewed helicopters. So we will be able to take full advantage of these released US Army helicopter pilots and crew. And we could have up to 6,500 of them.
Well, that all sounds perfect because they're getting rid of helicopters, making their people redundant.
Yep.
And we're getting more helicopters.
Yep.
American helicopters. So we need more people.
Well, we're getting American helicopters. Why shouldn't we have American helicopter pilots?
That sounds terrific. There's just one little wrinkle.
Yes.
Why are we getting more crewed helicopters at the same time they're saying crewed helicopters
are not effective in future combat? Okay, look.
Right,
I think
maybe
we'll
should move
leave
on.
It on the good news.
Yes.
That's the important thing. All right, well, Marcus, it was great to talk with you. It's great to be back in the bunker. And once I do deploy the littoral kayak, I think we will at least have some point defense for the bunker here in the nation's capital.
All right. Well, we'll see you next time.
See you.